Well, we are beginning here in Mark chapter 6, verse 30. And we're going to go on down through 44. Both of these next 2 weeks are going to be some more pretty popular passages about Jesus, some pretty popular events in his life. In fact, today's is so popular, it's one of two events that's recorded in all four Gospels as far as miracles go. So I should rather maybe say one of two miracles that's recorded in all four Gospels. There's this and the resurrection of Jesus. That's it. That's how powerful this moment was. So you can find it in, like I said, all four Gospels, an account of this feeding of the 5,000. Mark's is, at least of the three synoptic Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Mark's is the most detailed, and John gives us some extra information that I'll splice in here every now and then, just because he helps gives us, as he does in most places where they overlap, John helps us give some extra little insight that we were missing in the other three. So the other thing just to kind of note, and we're not going to linger on this long, when we get a little bit further down into chapter 11, we're going to talk a lot more about this style of writing that Mark does. But I'll just point it out here because it kind of matters and just the progress of our story. But Mark often sandwiches his stories a lot. He'll start with one story, like he told us about the disciples, the apostles who got sent out by Jesus, that they went out and healed the sick. And then we had this interlude about the death of John the Baptist. And now we're going to pick back up with the apostles. And so Mark tends to do that, make these Mark sandwiches somewhat frequently. And like I said, I want to just point that out today because it's kind of just a part of how we can understand the narrative unfolding here. And we'll talk more about kind of how we can use those sandwiches and when we can pick them out in Mark when we get a little further along into chapter 11. So with that in mind, I want to read for us all the way verses 30 through 44, and then we'll hop into it. So here we go, Mark chapter 6, beginning in verse 30. The apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. And he said to them, "Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while." For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in a boat to a desolate place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them. And they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd. And he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered them, "You shall give them something to eat." And they said to him, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And when they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then he had commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to the heaven and said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them all. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up the 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men. Okay, so let's go back to the top. We'll kind of pick through our story. And then, as always, we'll come to some conclusions for ourselves after we look through the text here. So, kind of beginning in verse 30 to 32 here, we have, like I said, our introduction, the transition back into the story of the apostles. We had pointed out that previously in chapter 6 that the apostles had gone out in the authority of the name and power of Jesus, and that they had been preaching for repentance to God, and they had been performing miracles, and they'd been casting out demons. Then, like we've said, we had this interlude about John, and now we're here back with the apostles. So they've returned to Jesus, and they told him all that they had done. Here's all these healings, Jesus. Jesus, listen to this preaching and all the people who had repented. Jesus, listen to this town that had rejected us. And we shook the dust off our feet and went. And so Jesus, he says, all right, well, hey, we're going to kind of have this debrief time, this rest time. He sees their need for that. And they're going to go away. They're going to rest for a while. It says that for many were coming and going, and they hadn't even had the leisure to eat. These guys had been on the move. Life had been busy. And so now Jesus wants to take them to a place of rest. Jesus can bring us to rest. We can be satisfied in that. He saw their physical need and wants to bring them to rest. Now, where they go is John, again, like we said, we're going to sprinkle in some Johns here. John tells us that they go to this town of Bethsaida. We don't know 100%, but we're pretty sure there was this town called Bethsaida Julius. It's like 5 miles to the east of Capernaum. We know where Capernaum is, right on like the very northern part of the Sea of Galilee. We know that's where Jesus does a lot of his early ministry that we've been reading about so far. And so that seems like the most likely candidate. We're not 100% sure that's the right Bethsaida, but we're just about sure. And so they head over here and they head to this nearby place where they're going to go up into this wilderness. This was just a tiny little fishing village. But what's interesting about this tiny little fishing village is that we're told it's the hometown of Philip and of Nathanael, the apostles. And it's also the birthplace hometown, like Bethlehem was for Jesus, of Andrew and Peter. So four of our apostles at least were born here. Two of them like still was their hometown, even though Peter and Andrew had just moved the 5 miles over to Capernaum for bigger business. So even though this is kind of just an irrelevant little fishing town in the scope of global politics, in the lives of the apostles, they're kind of going home. They're going to rest in the wilderness that they're familiar with. I mean, even the ones that aren't from Bethsaida, like we said, they're probably just from 5 miles over. Judas Iscariot is the only one who's not from this area in Galilee. Even Jesus is from this area around the northwestern side of Galilee. And so this is going home, going out to the wilderness to rest. That's what they're headed for. But we see here, continuing on in our story, that that's not quite what they're going to get. It says in 33, "Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things." Think about that. They're on the boat. Okay, the boat's not motorized, old school boat. We're moving by the wind, but still, we're on a boat, and we're cutting as the crow flies from shore to shore. We're not having to go around the arch of the shore. And yet there's some who ran the whole way to beat Jesus there because they saw him. They so desired, for we're not told for whatever reason. You know, we're kind of told that they recognized him from the miracles, but we're not told about the intention of the heart. I would guess that there's probably some who had very sure intentions of the heart, some who desired. They saw Jesus and heard his messages for repentance, and they wanted to join the number of the disciples, the ones who were following after him. And then I also think, because it's the same experience that I see in our world now, that there's a lot of people who just want to chase the crowd. They want to chase the fame and the attention and the big to-do. And if you're living in little old Galilee, if you're living in the countryside of an already countryside kind of part of the Roman Empire, and all of a sudden here's this miracle worker who's moving around in your neighborhood. Yeah, I want to go see that. I want to go be a part of that. He's healing people. Maybe I can get healed. I don't know. I'm not even messed up, but I'm a little short, so maybe give me a couple inches. You know, it's like, I just want to go and run and see Jesus. So for whatever reason, these people, they go on a good old run, several miles to go beat Jesus's boat to meet him on the shore. And I'm sure there was others who were running too and just weren't quite as fast as the boats, and they just joined the crowds. But when Jesus comes up, it says that he has compassion on them. It's not that he shows up and he's frustrated because, oh man, I just wanted to get away for a weekend with the boys. Come on. For once, can we not have a crowd here? He sees them and he has compassion. It says, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Now, I think Mark's point that Mark really wants to drive at is the same in a big picture way as what John wants to drive at. But I think Mark, his intention in the way that he approaches it, the avenue he approaches it is a little different. We'll get to kind of what I think Mark is trying to do and how it relates to some of the other miracles Mark has been speaking about. But when John is speaking about this, a big part of what he's trying to do, why we sang the song, is prove that Jesus is this better Moses. Let me flip us back to Numbers 27 real quick. So over in Numbers 27, Moses is, he's about to get some of the last instruction from God. And then the Israelite people are going to go on their way into the promised land as his life comes to an end. So this is in Numbers 27, starting in verse 12. This is kind of in the last conversation between Moses and God. Here's what it says. The Lord said to Moses, "Go up into this mountain of Abiram and see the land that I have given to the people of Israel. When you have seen it, you shall be gathered to your people as your brother Aaron was, because you rebelled against my word in the wilderness of Zin when the congregation quarreled, failing to uphold me as holy at the waters before their eyes." Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, "Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who shall go out before them and come in before them, who shall lead them out and who shall bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be sheep that have no shepherd." So Moses is identifying, "Lord, I've been the one who has been leading your people since the Exodus through these last 40 years in the wilderness. And so if I now and not am going to join them, they will be without a shepherd. Lord, please give them a shepherd." And in those next verses, he says, okay, Joshua is going to be, and they are led by Joshua. Joshua leads that conquest into the Holy Land. But for Moses, he sees that. He has compassion on his people, and he says, please do not leave them without a shepherd. And we could go through the Old Testament. We've talked about it before already. But we could go through the Old Testament and the prophets, and we can see how the shepherds of that day, the priests, were declared wicked, and then God said he would come, and that he would bring the shepherd who would be before them. And so, for like I said, with John, I think he's trying to make this point about Moses, and we can see it here too, even in this statement with Mark, that he has compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. He saw his people and desired to lead them. You know, we have a little bit of an advantage over, you know, someone who lives in, let's say, Los Angeles their whole life. We understand a little bit about the countryside, but even still, most of us day to day aren't shepherds. That might not be something we're totally familiar with, and I'm not either. I've spent a little bit of time helping take care of some goats and sheep, and I've done some research into shepherds for this very conversation that we're about to have, but I myself am not a day-to-day shepherd. So there's a little bit of an aspect of this that we miss, whereas the Israelite people, who for 2,000 years had been shepherding for a major part of their resource and economy, did think about. That a shepherd wasn't just the one who was merely protecting the livestock from enemies, wasn't merely the one who was shearing them for their wool and at the end of their days butchering them for their meat so that he might benefit. No, think to Psalm 21. "You go prepare the table lands before me so that I may come and eat." A shepherd goes, doesn't just protect the flock from the dangers that are coming to them, but he goes to their future pasture and he prepares it for them so they might feed and be full. He finds it, he leads them there, and he protects them while they enjoy. So Jesus, seeing his sheep who were hungry for much more than just food that he's going to give them later, he feeds them. He has compassion on them. He has mercy on them. And to the point that we were making last week, yes, we aren't Jesus. We aren't the best of all shepherds. We aren't the head shepherd. But we are called to disciple people as we grow in our own maturity and faith. And we want to imitate Christ and be as Christ-like as possible. And so if he is a shepherd and we see we are called to shepherd people, then we ought to have compassion on those who are hungry and who have a need to be fed. And it's what we were looking at last week. We don't want to just look at the slave who's in chains and say, "How dare you put yourself in chains?" We want to look there and recognize we all were, and we were freed by Jesus, not by ourselves. And so in the same way, hopefully we see people who are hungry and needing to be fed, and we don't say, "How dare you not already live according to something you don't know?" But we see sheep who are hungry, and we bring them to the table and so that they might choose to eat of the food that we know how satisfactory it is. So this is Jesus. He sees them, And rather than shooing them away and saying, hey, I came here to be with these guys to hear about what they've done, he goes and he starts feeding them. He heads up on the hill and he starts teaching. Mark doesn't tell us exactly what he was teaching. It just says, and he began to teach them many things. I would guess that he probably recounts a lot of what he said in the Beatitudes. I would bet that he probably preaches a lot of the same repentance that he's been speaking to everyone else that we've been reading about in Mark. That the people who were sitting here and listening to him were being called to come to God, to hear his word, and to follow his teaching. That there were these 12 apostles in the boat with him, but there were these many other disciples who were following him as well, that they might join that number. That there would be cost to this. Did we not read about the death of John just last week? One who avowed that Jesus was the greater one to come than him. There was cost. But there was worthwhile too. I have to think that even though I don't know the exact words Jesus uses because it's not recorded, that I can imagine pretty well what he might be teaching in this moment. It says in verse 35, and when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, this is a desolate place and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. You know, I don't think the disciples were, you know, in a worldly sense wrong here. They're considering the people who are here. They're recognizing the lack of resources. They're like, hey, we don't have food. We haven't eaten in a couple days here. These people definitely don't. We can't do everything. We don't have the money to feed ourselves for much more than the next week. We definitely can't feed them for this whole crowd. So just send them on out, Jesus. They'll come back and find us. But here's the problem. When we're just caught up in exclusively worldly thinking, even when it's unintentional, we can end up limiting what God can do. These guys, they were so caught up in the, hey, here's what I can do. I can buy bread and I can buy fish and I can go and I can bring that to these people. But I don't have the money to do that. I don't have the time to do that. And these people didn't bring food out here themselves. So what are we going to do, Jesus? They limit the fact. What were they just doing? Things way outside of themselves. They were just healing the sick and the blind and the lame. They were just casting out demons, doing so much beyond themselves, but they couldn't even fathom this. And so I don't think they were intentionally trying to put Jesus in a box. I just think that by them not saying, God, you are the master of all creation, and whatever you're going to do in this moment, do it. We just don't know what it is. Can you please tell us? Instead of coming to him with that attitude, they came to him just with worldly thinking. I'm not saying it's wrong for us to do the wise thing. We should live wisely. Be good stewards of the resource God has to us. But when we're sitting in a circumstance and we're recognizing, I don't exactly see a logical worldly situation here. Hopefully as Christians, our first thought isn't just to panic. Hopefully our first thought isn't just to self-destruct or to run away from our principles. Hopefully our first thought is to turn to the Lord and say, I don't know what you have in plan, but whatever it is, please, I trust you. But you're going to have to do something here, or at least show me what the thing is, because I don't know. And that's these guys. They're in this spot where it's like they can't even fathom the thought of this something out of nothing that's about to happen. So, Jesus answers them. It says, you give them something to eat. Again, in John, over in John 6:6, it tells us that Jesus knows what he was about to do, and he's just testing them. You give them something to eat. Did I not just send you out as my apostles? Did you not just go and feed the people? If they're so hungry, feed them. What would it have looked like if the apostles had just turned around and started preaching more? Or if they had turned to Jesus and said, okay, what miracle would you have us do? Point us in the way. But that's not it. When Jesus tests them and says, you give them something to eat, have you caught on yet? They swing and miss. And they said to him, we shall go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat. They totally miss the point. So they go and Jesus says, how many loaves do you have? Go and see. And when they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then he commanded them all to sit down in groups on green grass. So they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties. So it's interesting. We know where this story is going. We read the whole thing. Our Creator, who is about to create, puts things in order. Where have I heard that before? Oh, yeah, Genesis, when God creates the whole world and first puts things in order by separating the light and the darkness, by separating everything out of the void. And then he makes what he intends for it. And here's Jesus doing the very same thing. I mean, previously, he's had a lot of command, a lot of power. He's even given other people power. Now he's creating. What they had, that five loaves and two fish, I mean, I don't think any of us are sitting here imagining this number and thinking, okay, yeah, but you can really stretch a couple loaves of bread. I mean, what are we talking about? But just for our sake of understanding just what we are talking about, we're not even talking about a big, fresh, you know, sourdough loaf. We're talking about a thin cracker. Probably some sardines. You know, it's a little boy's lunch that he's packed in his bag. So if you can imagine something about the size of a sheet of paper that's about the same thickness as what we eat for our communion bread, and a couple pickled fish, that's a little boy's lunch. And we're going to turn this into something. What's incredible is in all of this, and part of why we can pretty well assume that it's a cracker like that, is that we can see, again, in John, because he says it, that it's Passover time. But also, because of just reading what we see here, the grass being green and the way that it grows, we know the season in which the grass is green like that. We know that they take in one of the other Gospels, they mention that it's barley loaf, and we know that barley is what's being harvested at this time. And so during this time of Passover, where they're celebrating the Lord who leads them out of this, again, back to Jesus being this better Moses. So he brings order, and then he creates. It says, and taking the 5 loaves and 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them. When he said a blessing and broke the loaves, he did the same thing we do before we eat. He gave thanks for it. I mean, he's going to do something special with it, but he didn't bless it in the sense of like, if you eat this, you're going to turn into Spider-Man. It was just blessed in the sense of it was offered to the Lord in thanks. And so we follow along and do the same thing. When he broke the loaves and the disciples passed it out among them, it says in verse 42, and they ate and they were all satisfied. That word satisfied, the term that it means would be full, complete. Not one in this crowd was left sitting around looking for seconds and saying, all right, I'll make it, I guess. There's nothing left at the table. No, everyone was full, totally satisfied. And notice, he sends out the apostles to be the ones to set it before the people. And our God, who is a perfect creator, sovereign over all, who sets all things into order, is able to keep things, all things in order, to where every single person is full and there's exactly one full basket for each apostle to bring back. We don't need to look too hard into the numbers, but we talked about 12, this perfect, divine, sovereign reign. The 12 apostles, the 12 tribes. And here we see it again, these 12 baskets that God didn't just make an excess and hope it was enough. He knows exactly how much he needs so that even you might still be full with a basket while your body itself is full. The last thing just to kind of point out here is that... Well, I guess two last things to point out here before we kind of turn to some last reflections. It mentions that those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men, and it also says the same in some of the others. But Matthew points out that this is 5,000 men, not counting the women and the children. And so we're not just talking about Jesus feeding 5,000. We're talking upwards of probably past 10,000, maybe even 15,000. If along with the men was their wives, their sisters, their mothers, their children. If there's 5,000 men, it's quite likely that this crowd is double that, if not triple that. This is a massive crowd that's out there. And then just the last thing to point out again, as we're kind of referencing over to John, they declare, John tells us that they're so taken by this that they say that this must be the prophet. In Deuteronomy 18, 15 through 19, we see where Moses, again, in this end of his days, is told that from the people, there would be one who has the voice of the Lord, that he would raise up a prophet. And both us as Christians and Jews identify that as a passage about the Messiah. And so the Jewish people declare about him in chapter 6 that this must be the prophet who is to come in the world, it says in verse 14. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. So these people, they are taken back by what's happened. It's not that they're ungrateful, but here's what he tells us in John chapter 6, just a little further down. That night after this is when Jesus walks on the water, and that's what we'll look at next week. But then in John, after, in the next morning, Jesus comes back to the crowd. And this is what he tells them. So this is John chapter 6, verses 26 and 27. Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you are seeking me, not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. Do not work for food that perishes, but for the food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you, for on him God the Father has set his seal." These people are amazed and, again, not unthankful. They declare that he's the Messiah. We want him to be the King of Galilee. Out with Herod Antipas, in with Jesus. But Jesus knows this isn't what his moment is for at this time. And he slips away. So I want us to just kind of consider some things here. Like we've kind of been doing, there's two sides of things. The first side of things is we can be the person who's just searching for fish to fill our bellies. God saw everyone who was here. Everyone who was here. Those who were going to come to believe in him. Those who are not. Those who at the moment were following him as disciples. And it's going to fall away here in just a few short chapters, it says. He sees all of them. And he doesn't just call forward the apostles and say, "You guys have been pretty good. Here's some bread and fish for you. Hey, Tina back in row 7, seat 8. I really like what you've been doing. You come on up." No, he gives common grace to everyone. That's the term that we use as Christians, common grace, grace for everyone. The reality that each and every single one of us are transgressors against God. That each and every single one of us, before coming to Jesus at least, was guilty. And God would have every right to say, "Well, then judgment comes." But we weren't. We still were drawing breath and given the chance to turn to him. And we were able to enjoy life. We were able to have jobs and homes and friends and family. God gives grace to all men to enjoy this world for at least the period of our lives. That common grace isn't the saving grace. That's separate. That's through Jesus. But all men, all people get this common grace. And here it's experienced. That Jesus has fed everyone who is attendance. They ate till they were completely full and satisfied. But some simply seek to be satisfied in their worldly needs. Here's what Jesus says over in Luke chapter 10. Again, just this is right on the heels of him feeding. That happens over in chapter 9. And then in chapter 10, here's what he says. "Woe to you, Chorazon. Woe to you, Bethsaida. For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago, sitting in sackcloth and ashes. But it will be more bearable in the judgment for Tyre and Sidon than for you." If we have read in our Old Testament, Tyre and Sidon are two Phoenician cities on the coast, and the prophets speak judgment against them often for being enemies of Israel. And what we know is that the Persian Empire went and conquered both of them. Alexander went and conquered both of them. Rome comes and conquers both of them. It wasn't a pretty time for those cities for a couple hundred years. But they finally come back and they're starting to get some life in them again. Judgment for Bethsaida, it'll be worse than that for them. I think here's why. Here's from Romans chapter 1. I'm going to start in verse 19. We'll read 19 and 20. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. Now, Paul's speaking about all men. How we're all a part of creation. We should all recognize the glory of God in us who are created and the world created around us. But Bethsaida, who sat here and witnessed with their own eyes the Creator in front of them, create and would not believe. Judgment was coming for them. They ought to have seen the glory of God through what Jesus had done. So are we searching for fish to feed our belly? Are we satisfied enough with just common grace? Hey, life is good. Worldly things are good. I'm just going to live it up here and then whatever. I find it to be wholly unsatisfactory. There's nothing that I've ever found in worldly living that was pleasing beyond just instantaneous gratification. It usually came around as being worse in the long run perspective. The things of this world that we're called to walk away from as believers, there's nothing we're leaving behind worth keeping. What do you want to keep? Greed? You want that to consume you? What do you want to keep? Lust? Do you want that to consume you? What do you want to keep? Pride? Do you want that to consume you? There's nothing that we're called to walk away from that's worth keeping in your life. The things that are worth it in this world are the things that we're able to enjoy. He doesn't call us to just sit in a gray-walled room and pads and just wait it out till he comes. Enjoy the fruit of this world that he gave us. Look around where we live, how beautiful the creation is. He made that for us to enjoy in. Enjoy it. But equally, understand why we get to enjoy it with full joy. Because if we're the one who's just seeking satisfaction, if all we ever enjoy is say, oh, that's a pretty rock right over there, and we sell ourselves short of the foundation of why that's a pretty rock. Oh, it has colors. That's nice. Lots of things have colors. No, that's a pretty rock because our God made it. That he looked at all of that, and then he looked at you, and he thought you were better. That's what makes that beautiful. So for us to be satisfied, what do we find true satisfaction in? We find it in Jesus. Why? Here you go. We're getting back to the Baptist home beat. I got 3 points. Why can we find satisfaction in Jesus? Well, he's our sovereign creator with almighty power. He's just displayed this, and he's been displaying it over and over and over and over again in Mark. Sickness, illness, disease, yeah, I got that cleared. Demons, nothing. An army of them, psh, see ya. Death itself, I have control over that. And I can take all of this power and give it to them. Oh, by the way, I can be here and create. I can take these fish and they can fill you. I won't even just make an illusion and make you think there's lots of fish. You'll eat and be satisfied, and we'll have leftovers, more leftovers than we started with. Jesus is our sovereign creator, and we can be satisfied when we look around and see what he's made for us and that he's put us here. And not just that he's put us here, but that he dwells with us as our shepherd. That Jesus came, he saw his people, and he had compassion on them. That now we have the Spirit who walks with us and is present with us at all times. When you're at home chopping carrots for the stew, God is with you. When you're on the road driving to Cedar City for your appointment, God is with you. At all times, the presence of God is with you, and you can be satisfied in that. Not only that, but again, in that same conversation of where John 6, just after that very next morning where he's speaking to the people, he says to them, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst. We're satisfied in Jesus, not just because he's great and almighty. We're not satisfied in Jesus just because he's great and almighty and came to be around us, but that so we might be participants in him, so that we might enjoy the true bread of life, which will never leave us hungry. They just ate the bread that left them not being hungry. So how good was that? What I'm truly offering you is better, Jesus is saying. So why would we not be satisfied in that? Why am I satisfied? I think we could, if you wanted to just make like specific individual reasons, I think you could make a list that is endless. But to put it in a kind of a big picture way, I'm satisfied because the basic philosophical needs as a human creation are satisfied. I understand my nature. I know who I am. I'm a creation of God, made in His image, broken by sin, but restored by Him. I understand me, who I am. I can look at my life, at the world experience that I live, and understand things about me that would be missing without God. Why do I desire things that I don't desire? Why am I unable to control these things in my body? I'd be lost. I'd be left to, oh, well, I guess I'm just a series of chemicals firing off. I'm a pretty good program that randomly happened to exist. That's no satisfaction. That's no satisfaction. Instead, I understand, no, the God of all things made me in His image to be a steward of His creation. And that even though I was broken by this world, He came and restored me. And that's my nature now as a new creation. Not only is my nature answered, my purpose is clear. I understand that I exist to glorify God and enjoy Him. That I might be able to live my life so that others could see and know Him. And that in living that life so others can see and know Him, I might have joy. That's satisfactory. And lastly, not only is my nature clear, not only is my purpose clear, but my future is clear. That I might know that it's not just now that's taken care of. It's not that just I get to live a life now with some hope. But this is life eternal. That I get to reside with this Jesus, my good shepherd, forever. And I'm satisfied. I'm not burdened by it. I'm not saying, well, I guess this is the better option, but oh, it's close. No, fully satisfied. No debate. Give me this 11 out of 10 times. And please take that as far away as possible. It's starting to smell up the room a little bit. Don't like that option. I will choose the life and the bread of life that Jesus offers every time because it is satisfactory. It is satisfactory to see and know what the world offers is just a sweet little treat on a mousetrap, ready to snap and break your neck. And it's so ready for us to live in a world stuck and squirming in that trap. What Jesus has to offer, this bread of life, it will satisfy. And it will not just satisfy, but it will renew and restore, bring you into a new creation, into eternal life with Him, a promised future, a hope that we have. We can read and know when He says, our psalm that's in our bulletin today, when He says in Psalm 23, that you will have no worries with Him as your shepherd. It's true. It's true. Let's pray.